From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from friends and colleagues of the late Milwaukee Alderman Jonathan Brostoff, who died by suicide earlier this month. Then, local therapists share advice on coping with the grief that comes with a sudden loss.
I also like to think of grief not as something that is painful and should be avoided, but as another active way to honor and love the person that we've lost.
Plus, Indigenous chef Elena Terry talks about the cultural significance of food and Thanksgiving.
But let's acknowledge that everywhere people live on Native land. And so who are the people that occupied that land before you? And how can we maybe start making forward steps into reclaiming what this beautiful space once was?
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Before we start, I'd like to take a moment to caution listeners about the contents of today's show. Our first two pieces deal with the topic of suicide. If you or anyone you know is in a crisis or thinking about suicide, trained help is available. You can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988. Earlier this month, Milwaukee lost one of its most tenacious advocates. Alderman Jonathan Brostoff died by suicide at just 41 years old. He leaves behind a wife, four children, and a community, struggling to come to terms with this loss. During his life, Brostoff was a tireless advocate for his community, both as a state representative and later as a member of the Milwaukee Common Council. In the wake of his passing, the outpouring of grief and love has been immense. Now we'll hear from some of the people who knew and loved Jonathan.
I'll remember Jonathan as a friend, a colleague, an activist who, every time he entered a space, brought so much energy and light. He was a vessel of light. If he saw you, whatever it was you were doing, he was going to affirm you, support you. In my case, Shorewood Farmers Market, that's where I would run into him the most throughout the summer months. Jonathan would never walk by my table without a conversation and a purchase. And he was going to take a picture, which is why so many of us have photos with Jonathan, because he initiated that. He wanted to take that photo. I will remember him as a father, because most of the time at that farmer's market, those beautiful children, as they kept coming into the world, would be with him. I will remember him as an ally, and I want to specifically say that and say public allies. That's where I got to know Jonathan. He is representative of the power of public allies that has done so much good for the city of Milwaukee. And so I will remember him officially as an ally and personally as an ally. And he is missed.
Jonathan Brostoff could be best understood by how he played a game of basketball. Make no mistake, Jonathan was never confused for Giannis Antetokounmpo, nor a varsity high school player. He wasn't tall. He wasn't fast. He couldn't shoot. He looked none of the part. But just like in everything he did, you quickly learned you wanted Jonathan on your team. Jonathan had all the skills you can't teach. He hustled. He cared. He paid attention. He tried hard. He was honest, and he included everyone. On the basketball court, this manifested itself in the consummate team player. He was always setting screens on offense, poking the ball away on defense, and rallying his teammates. He had his signature full-court press. Without fail, Jonathan would surprise the other team by unleashing his one-man, end-line-to-end-line defense. It was a free 2 points for his team. Jonathan brought that same energy to the rest of his life. He won a super competitive assembly race in 2014 to launch his political career. Those of us who had played basketball with him for years weren't surprised. He simply outworked his three opponents by knocking on more doors and appearing at more events. His signature legislative accomplishment at the Capitol was a licensing program for sign language interpreters. But the process to get there was as absurd as his trash talk on the basketball court. After it was initially rejected by the Republican-controlled legislature, he pledged to the disability rights community not to cut his hair until it was a law. He went 17 months without a haircut, yielding quite the, quote, Jufro, but also a visible sign that he was working on something. The large number of people that showed up in an East Side parking lot when he finally got his haircut was indicative of the Big Ten style of how he lived his life. I watched him multiple times meet someone at an event and turn to the next person to introduce the person he just met as if they were an old friend. Playing basketball with Jonathan was the same experience. He'd text you about meeting to play at a park. Then you got there and he had someone in tow that he just met. Whether it was a movie night at his house, a game of pickup basketball, knocking doors for a political candidate, or playing Magic the Gathering, Jonathan was always making friends and bringing them along. Our longtime personal friendship took on a professional twist when he was elected to the Common Council, which I cover for Urban Milwaukee. Just like his full court press on the basketball court, Jonathan stepped into office ready to advocate with high intensity for what he believed in. He brought passionate advocacy for sustainable urban development and safe streets for all to the council. Jonathan was always thinking several steps ahead about how to get the next thing passed. The energy came as a surprise to many of his new colleagues, but not to anyone who had ever stepped on the basketball court with him. Jonathan was a leader and a friend to all who knew him.
Jonathan was one of the first people I met when I moved to Milwaukee back in 2006. I used to see him at UWM all the time when I worked with the ACLU. And he was always in the student union, fighting for social justice and equal rights, supporting the different events we were doing, promoting the local youth Dems component. He was just an all-around infectiously good-humored fighter. He was a good egg. We used to connect over everything from Star Wars to board games. He was one of the first people to come over and become a Milwaukee Turner when I moved over here too. I've always appreciated his love and support. I remember, you know, having the pleasure of holding Barack and Boaz and Binyamin and Yael. I remember bringing food over after his car accident and playing with him and the babies. And sometimes we'd just sit in the porch and take a look at stuff and play with the kids. This is a very deep loss, not only as a friend, and I can't imagine what's going on in Deanna or Alan or Phyllis's world, but to Milwaukee and Wisconsinites in general. Jonathan was such a force, right? Such a great energy. And I think this underscores the need for all of us to make sure that we check in with the people we care about. It was terrible to go and to be in the same place where I had helped toss Jonathan up and down on a chair for his wedding to come to a close, a circle, to celebrate his life in that same center. Such a terrible and abrupt thing. But I hope that all of us can honor his commitment to Milwaukee, his commitment to one another, his long-standing life lesson. I'll never forget you, brother.
Me and Jonathan were very close. Since that fateful day, my first week at UWM, I haven't been able to shake him. First, you know, club night meetings, then we went to dinners and birthdays and college parties. Then he dragged me along to run his first campaign, and he got me and my wife to run his events, and then a deputy campaign manager, knock on doors. We traveled across the world together. We vacationed together in Mexico. We were 30 seconds from the beach, and we watched the sunrise come up over the Gulf. We watched sea turtles hatch and swim back into the water. We swam in underground caves. We had movie nights. We had video game nights. We traveled to Chicago. He stood up at my wedding. We had children, virtually the same age, 8 months apart, our first sons. He helped me when my father passed away. That's what hurts the most. We were supposed to raise our sons together. We made so many plans for the future. We were supposed to do sleepovers and go glamping and take him to summer camp. And I dreamed of joining the scouts with him, and all those dreams will go unfulfilled. I spoke to him nearly every week, if not every day. You know, most people want to change the world, but he did. I'm living in it. I wish I knew how much Jonathan was suffering. When you're someone like Jonathan, you spread yourself pretty thin. He was a wonderful father, but I think he loved his constituents too. Sometimes you just have to step back. It's just a job. Jonathan didn't see it that way. I'm going to miss him. He was part of my life every day. And life's never going to be the same without him. A lot of people knew him, but I loved him.
So I know Jonathan for about 8 years or so, and throughout these 8 years, we've been working on different mental health programming and suicide prevention programming really this entire time, from bringing the suicide prevention programming to Madison, to Milwaukee City Hall, and to other places as well. And after his passing, when I was trying to think, what can we, like, how do you respond to something like this? I think back to all the work we did together, and we want to do what we did and just do it again and again and again. We want to make every year and every moment that he lived count for everything Jonathan stood for. And in my world, it was the mental health work that we did together with Friendship Circle and him. And that's why we went to this, especially the way he passed, you know, was aligned with the work that we were doing. And so we were launching the We Can Save Lives tour, and we're going to do 41 suicide prevention trainings over the course of the next 10 or so months. And we want to train over 1,000 people in Safe Talk suicide prevention training. If you want to make sure that Jonathan's life really counts for as much as possible, you know, sharing stories is important, you know, documenting his memories are important, but doing something to help someone else is even more important.
That was Venus Williams from Alice's Garden, Jeremy Janine from Urban Milwaukee, Emilio De Torre from the Milwaukee Turners, and Jonathan Brostoff's former colleague and close friend, Alexander Dominguez. We also heard from Rabbi Levi Stein, the executive director of the Friendship Circle of Wisconsin. They all shared their memories of late Milwaukee alderman Jonathan Brostoff. Beginning tomorrow, Stein will be hosting the first of 41 Safe Talk suicide prevention trainings in honor of Brostoff. You can find more information about the trainings at fcwi.org. If you or anyone you know is in a crisis or are thinking about suicide, trained help is available for you. You can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988. Later this hour, we'll hear from Chef Elena Terry, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, on how food can teach us to accept imperfections in ourselves and others.
We're all part of this greater community, but that doesn't mean we're not part of our tribe. We're the great Ho-Chunk Nation. So how do we treat each other like that and recognize that, like, you are beautiful with all your imperfections, and if anything, stand alongside me, because I'm here for you. Like, I see you, you know, like, you have value to me.
But first, we'll speak with two local therapists about how to process grief, both individually and as a community. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A note to listeners, our next conversation deals with suicide and grief. When someone dies by suicide, there are a lot of unanswered questions that can complicate the grieving process. As many in our Milwaukee community are mourning the loss of Alderman Jonathan Brostoff, we wanted to take a moment to talk about grief, how we deal with it individually, and how we can heal collectively. Emily Vandervelden is a local psychotherapist, and Jeremy Schumacher is a licensed marriage and family therapist. They join me now to talk about what this kind of grief and healing can look like. Emily, Jeremy, thank you both so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I think this is an issue that always requires a lot of sensitive language, and that really speaks to the ways in which we culturally deal with suicide, but also the ways in which we individually deal with suicide. And I think one of the big questions that emerges, because deaths by suicide feel different, how is losing someone by suicide different than losing someone to something else?
That's a good question. I can speak to that a little bit to start. I've heard that when somebody loses a loved one to suicide, they take on the pain that that person could no longer bear. And it's often without warning. It's often something that is kept a secret. And it is so tragic because of that, because I think when someone is in a place where they are contemplating suicide, they're thinking about the world as if it is isolated from them, as opposed to the fact that the world cares about them and wants to be there. And so when someone loses a loved one by suicide, they often feel as if something was taken from them that didn't need to be lost. And then they feel those ripples of pain and grief.
Yeah, I think grief and loss are complicated. There's so many variables that go into it. The human brain is a storytelling brain. And so we want to sort of have a start, a middle, and an end. And a death from suicide often is an abrupt end, an unplanned end, and leaves a lot of questions. So we don't always have that narrative that, oh, they lived a nice long life, or it's an end to their suffering, or some of these other platitudes we use around death. We don't always have those things. And sometimes we're left with more questions than answers. And so I think that too can be a complicating factor, that there's not a easy way to sort of wrap it up and put a story on it that makes sense to us. It's something that really doesn't make sense. It's something that we have a hard time wrapping our brain around.
When someone dies by suicide, as you say, there are a lot of questions that feel unanswered. What are some of the questions and the concerns, the feelings that you hear from people when they lose people in this way?
You know, Jeremy, I think you really touched on that idea of, right, it's the story. It's this thought of, what did I miss? What are the things that I didn't see coming? What could my role have been? You know, often people will think about the last interaction they had with that person and think, wow, were there any signs in that conversation? Is there anything I could have said that would have stopped this? It's almost like a sense of responsibility sometimes, a lot of what ifs.
When we think of things like depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, some of these things, like some of these mental health issues that stick with us for a long time. It's not a linear process to recover from them. It's one of those things where people will be happy, people will be gregarious and outgoing, and also carrying their own burdens or suffering on their own. So I think it is that sort of bargaining of, if I could have just done this thing differently, or if I had reached out more often, or why didn't they tell me where they were at? There's all these sort of, like, our brain wants to have some sort of control over the situation that we ultimately weren't able to control. And so we want to answer that question of, like, what could I have done differently? Because it helps it make sense. It puts it into our sphere of influence, as opposed to being something that isn't up to us.
That idea of control is, I think, really interesting inside of this, because it does feel as though so many people who I've spoken with, in light of a recent loss we had here in Milwaukee, so many people have said, you know, maybe I didn't see him as much as I used to, and maybe I should have noticed that, or, you know, the last time we spoke, he seemed so happy. And there are a lot of things that feel out of our control right now as we walk through this grief collectively, but also singularly. What are the ways that you coach people in how to move through grief, deal with these feelings, but also find some stable ground?
One of the big things I start with is to feel your feelings, to hold space for those, to lean into them, even instead of avoiding them. We as a culture don't have a lot of structure or sort of ritual activity around grief. And that's where, like, connecting to community, talk about those memories, remember those fond memories, even if it feels sort of disconnected from the current situation. Like, that's who that person was. That's the relationship we still had with them. That's the relationship we will maintain with them because their impact in our own lives. So, like, look at the old pictures, share the old photos, pull out the old photo albums and go through them. Like, I tell people to hold space for your feelings while you're going through all those things, because just because it's an unexpected or sort of a traumatic loss doesn't mean that the impact that person had in our lives or the way that we related to them was disingenuous or wasn't real. It just wasn't the whole story. And so, like, finding those things, connecting with people who remember that person, and, like, leaning in, sharing those connections and connecting with it, family, friends, community, whatever that looks like in your life, to say, like, this is the relationship I had with that person, and that relationship's still important.
Yeah, I love that. I also like to think of grief not as something that is painful and should be avoided, but as another active way to honor and love the person that we've lost, and understand that you know, that lack of control, that feeling of loss and being isolated and not grounded, you know, that's probably how our loved one felt to some extent. And in a way, being able to validate that and sit with that ourselves and grieve through that together is almost a way of honoring that person's pain and seeing them and supporting them in the way we can now. It's okay to sit with that pain. It's okay to hold it. And eventually it will start to change form. Maybe not always go away, but it might become more of a placeholder for that love and eventually turn into love and care.
One of the things I think people have found so painful about this specific loss is the person we're talking about was incredibly influential in our community. This was a person who, from basically all accounts, really spent their life trying to make the world a better place. And I think a lot of people are having difficulty squaring the acts of his life with the end of his life. How do we make sense of these kinds of dueling ideas of who a person is and was?
You know, I think what we can think about is the idea that we all contain multitudes, and there are parts of ourselves that are able to make significant change and give back and have a huge ripple effect on the community. And there are also parts that can be isolating and feel terribly sad and a lot of pain. And, you know, I think a lot of the time, someone like him who made such big impact on the community likely also feels the pain at a very deep level as well.
Like Emily said, both those things can be true, that someone can be that outgoing, connective person who's making the world a better place and also be somebody who's hurting. But also it can be something that ebbs and flows, that comes on quickly, that dissipates quickly. These aren't like permanent status effects that we have in our brain. They're things that can be managed really well and then spiral down, or can be a struggle and then some things fall into place and spiral up. So I think with mental health, it's just one of those things where we have this idea of an entire lifetime of mental health, as opposed to like a couple weeks or a couple months at a time. Our mental health can swing from one direction to another pretty quickly.
Now, as we look toward our collective future, moving through this grief, dealing with our own feelings personally and collectively, what are some of the ways that you suggest people can deal with these feelings both by themselves, but also as a group together in community?
A couple of things have already happened. Remembrances, tributes. There was a big mental health event recently in town. And I think a lot of people attended it. And I think it had maybe a different vibe or feel to it to talk about it with such a recent loss in the community. But I think those things are good. And I think taking the impact somebody had while they were with us and continuing that is a way to not only honor their memory, but to really keep them and the relationship we have with them going on in our lives. Just because they're not physically here doesn't mean they're still not impacting us and our community. And so I think that can be a way that people can take some of the grief, the hurt, the questions, the confusion they may have, and put it towards something that they can control. And that's a positive force, is to do some of that work. And my other thing you asked about individually and not just in community, I'm such a big believer in ritual, holding space for our brain and our body to interact through one practice. And we intellectualize grief. We sort of can cut our body off sometimes from what we're feeling, and as if mental health isn't housed within our body. And so I think having some space, whether that's, you know, whatever that looks like based on the person we're grieving, what they meant in our life. Maybe it's meeting at a certain place or going for a walk in a certain park. Maybe it's writing some feelings, listening to music, sharing some poetry. I like for people to write things and then they can burn it or they can bury it. They can tie it to a balloon and let it go. Like, there are all these ways where we can take what's going on in our head and create physical space for it so that our body and our brain are experiencing it at the same time. And so that's how I talk about ritual, I think. Again, a lot of our grief and loss, the funeral industry as a whole has become very sterile and doesn't hold a lot of space for us to sort of embody our grief and to let it exist in a physical space. So I think on a personal level, that can be collective too, but I think on a personal level, there's a looking for ritual and ways to sort of honor the complexities of the relationships that we're grieving.
I agree with everything you said, Jeremy. And I think something that I often think about is that healing happens in relationships. At the beginning of our life, we are held and we are rocked and we are soothed. That is still what we need. We need hugs. We need to just sit with somebody. We, like you said, Jeremy, go for a walk together. There is benefit in being intentional about just sitting with the people we love and being in presence with them. And holding that space intentionally without distraction can open up space for healing. And sometimes when we are still and we open up that space, our brain, which is wired to heal, wired to care for us, it will give us what we need to know, as long as we're open to hear it. And especially as a community, letting ourselves be open to each other so that we can co-create some narrative together about how we heal and how we move forward.
Well, Emily, Jeremy, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
It is a privilege to be able to speak to this joy. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, and thanks for wanting to talk about it. I think when there's a loss or there's grief, oftentimes people feel avoiding it or not discussing it directly, but we know that talking about these things openly and normalizing these is how we also move forward as a society, that people don't have to struggle or bear their burdens alone, that these are okay things to discuss openly and talk about with the people who care about us.
Emily van der Velden is a psychotherapist and owner of Renewed Focus Counseling. Jeremy Schumacher is a marriage and family therapist and owner of Wellness with Jer, LLC. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, trained help is available. You can talk to someone at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by dialing 988 or 800-273-8255. If you missed Tuesday's show and you want to hear our conversation with Kevin Kane about incentives to make your home more energy efficient, you can find it at WUWM.com on the Lake Effect page. If you ever miss an episode or want to take us on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, Wisconsin chef Elena Terry talks about cooking with indigenous foods. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you're a fan of Top Chef, you know last season was all about Wisconsin. But one guest chef may have caught your eye for her balance of creativity and tradition.
Elena is the founder of Wildberries, a nonprofit that promotes traditional farming techniques, and was named one of 2022's most influential Native American leaders of Wisconsin.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to greet you in my language, the Ho-Chunk language, and say welcome.
Thank you.
Before she was a Top Chef mentor, Elena Terry worked in the restaurant industry for more than a decade before switching to the role of full-time community builder. A member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, Terry founded Wildberries in 2017 to bring struggling members of her tribe back into community. The organization provides mentorship and vocational skills and expertise in seed-to-table cooking. Terry was profiled in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins Lake Effect Sam Woods for a conversation about Wildberries, the merits of traditional and experimental cooking, and what she'll be reflecting on during Thanksgiving.
Elena, I want to start with your relationship to food as a child. Can you tell me a story of food playing a role in your early life?
Sure. I mean, I have a very young food memory of being like a toddler and seeing my great-grandmother, who she was the one that they brought turtles to and wild game to clean. But most specifically, I remember a turtle because for us, they're like incredible figures in our stories, creation. They're like these ultimate warriors. They live on land and in the water, like these beautiful, very sacred beings they would take to my great-grandma to care for and to clean when we had ceremony. And she talked to them and prayed with them and explained what she was going to do so that their spirit knew why they were there. It was not a moment of fear or like being timid around what she was doing as she cared for these animals, but it was more like this deep sense of this is where I belong, like being outside at the fireplace with not just my great-grandmother, but my grandma and her sisters, and feeling like the warmth of the fire or smelling the smoke and hearing them speak Ho-Chunk. Like that for me, still to this day, is a very peaceful and comforting memory. And it is all centered around our traditional food.
How do you continue to honor that memory today?
I would say by being able to bring my children and my grandchildren around that same space and give them the experience as best that I can in this day and age with the same amount of nurturing and education that went with it. It was so much more than a process. It was an understanding. It was a spiritual connection. It was a lesson on land stewardship and caring for our animals. Like all of this was intertwined in that one act, you know, of really preparing a very sacred food for us. So when we're doing those actions or taking care of those very sacred foods in those spaces, I try to be as mindful as I can in instruction and in the space even, and having like good feelings and approaching it with prayer. It's the way we're supposed to live our lives. And it's continuing that teaching in those spaces.
So in addition to being a world-renowned chef, you also run an organization called Wildberries. Can you tell me a little bit about what Wildberries is and what it does?
Sure. So Wildberries was founded as a response to a call to action from our tribe. And around 2017, I mean, and still to this day, unfortunately, we've been suffering great loss from things like alcoholism, drug abuse, or addiction issues, even mental health issues in our community. And our tribe had these meetings and they said, you know, what can you do? What can you do as tribal members to promote community involvement, to get people to show up? And I was like, well, I can contribute in this very specific space. I can create a space in the kitchen. And we started by working with the tribal judge. I think they had a little conference for drug court and wellness, and they asked us if we could cater. And so I called people from the drug court who are participants to come in and cook with us. it just ended up being this beautiful movement of, if this is a very specific space that I can create and have for people who are trying to come back to their community, who are trying to overcome these incredibly difficult issues to overcome, maybe by sharing a meal or by sharing a kitchen space, they can know that they're still welcome. You know, like, our lives aren't meant to be perfect. And so why are we so judgmental when people stumble in our community to the point that they don't feel welcome back? So here's a way that we can build a bridge. Like, we can say, anybody in any situation, I don't know, for people who've worked in a restaurant, know that in a kitchen, if you're willing to show up and work hard, you can be successful in that space. So not only are we creating a bridge for them to come back to our community, but we're helping build life skills and vocational skills in the process. So it, for me, Wild Berries was a place where I could heal as well, where I could go and be a part of my community in a stronger and more grounded way, where I could still contribute, but do my job, which is a chef, which I love being, but I could also be a part of my tribe in a way where I felt I could contribute.
What stood out to me as you're describing Wild Berries' origin story is that, you know, there was this community-wide call to action. You know, we have this issue. We have people who feel like they're on the outs. How can we bring them in? And your contribution to that is saying, like, well, I have some skills. You know, I'm going to stand on that. I have some skills, and I can use those skills to help bring folks in. Am I hearing that correctly? Was that how this all got started? It was just like, hey, I can do this.
Yeah, yeah. And if I can do it, we can do it, right? Like, if I can do it, then I can help you. We can do it together. And it's this sense of, like, how did we forget what a tribe was? How did we forget what the very meaning of being a tribe is? And in celebrating individuality and saying that we're stronger together, like, it's bringing those core values back. When we have to exist in, you know, a capitalistic society, we're all part of this greater community, but that doesn't mean we're not part of our tribe. We're the great Ho-Chunk Nation. So how do we treat each other like that and recognize that, like, you are beautiful with all your imperfections, and if anything, stand alongside me, because I'm here for you. Like, I see you, you know, like, you have value to me.
Yeah. I want to move to a conversation about food as both tradition and experimentation. So, as you know, food is a flexible medium. On the one hand, you know, say you're preparing a squash soup in a traditional manner that connects you to cultural history, and the taste you get from that dish is a shared experience between you and generations before you who have prepared it in the same way and all that. But on the other hand, fusion food is incredible. I mean, you put some kimchi and some sweet chili sauce and, I don't know, some roasted garlic on a hot dog, and I'll be talking about it for months. I'm actually describing a hot dog I made this summer, so I have been thinking about this for months. But I'm curious how you balance these two truths. How do you know when it is appropriate to honor tradition in a dish and when it is appropriate to experiment and see what you can do?
I mean, there are times with my community when I'm cooking and I want it to be all ancestral. Like, I have seeds and corn that saved up just meant for our tribal communities, because that's all we have enough for. You know, we don't have enough to feed our greater community some of these very exclusive foods that are still coming back to us. So there are times when I'm like, this is going to be all decolonized, all very traditional. We're starting with a prayer in the morning. And then there are times when, you know, I was for a great part of my children's life, a single mother. And I want to cook foods that I'm going to get them to appreciate. Like, I want to use blue corn in a way that it's palatable to them without restriction. Like, if I want to make that in a cookie, I'm going to. Or if I'm going to, you know, have venison a different way and use potatoes, I don't like living in a box with restrictions, especially when it comes to food. Like, there are definitely times when I feel like the decolonized menu has to be the way to go, and I'm capable of doing that on a very high level. But I also think there's times when we really need to honor that, you know, food is food. And how are we going to choose to feed ourselves in this moment? Is it going to be by celebrating that I can make a cookie out of this ingredient, or I don't have to. You know, like I don't like limiting myself by certain parameters and just saying that not only is the food appreciated, but it's the process. And however I want to develop those flavors or develop your experience, enhance it, I'm going to do that without restriction, you know? So I really like to say, like, am I capable? Absolutely. Can I do it in any given moment, cook completely decolonized? That's like no beef, no chicken, no eggs, no dairy, all of these, wheat flour, you know? Or am I going to not limit myself with those parameters because I don't have to? Nobody said I absolutely have to. And am I going to give you an experience that you won't forget?
So say a dish is placed in front of you. Do you find yourself wondering what that dish's story is or the story of the chef behind that dish?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are times when you can tell that, you know, a chef is doing something because they believe that it's going to turn out good and it tastes good and it very technically is. But there's also these times when you have a bite and you're like, wow, like they brought me somewhere. Like I understand a much deeper sense of who the chef is based on this one bite. Like there can be very technically executed perfection in dishes where I'm like, it was okay. And there's other dishes that it's like, wow, I understand a little bit more. And they've brought me into their world. And I think that with a meal or a bite as a chef, that's the ultimate compliment, right? Is that's what you want. You want to engage your diner in an experience, not just a bite. And you want them to understand things a little bit more deeply, like to embed sensical memories from smell to sight to the taste. That's what the experience should be. And you can have a really good experience with a very well technically executed meal, but it's nothing compared to one where a chef is really engaging with you and bringing you on a journey.
Is there a dish you've had recently where it has just taken you on a journey like that? Mm-hmm. And I'm putting you on the spot. I'm sorry.
You know, there has been one bite, which I just had at the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival by Chef Claudette Zepeda. And it was amazing. And we were tasked to focus on local ingredients and the local purveyors and then make a dish based on what they kind of gave us a list. And she made this like tortilla crusted deep fried eggplant bite with smoked fish. And it looked very simple on a plate, like a scoop of fish on top of a little, you know, eggplant bite. But when you took a bite, it was like, oh, wow, there's smoky charred tortilla crisp and creamy eggplant. And like, not only is the smoke of the fish hitting you, but on the back end, you get the chili, which like is 100% Claudette. And I was like, wow, she really nailed this. And like everything I could have expected from her was in this one bite. You know, like that is what you hope to achieve as a chef.
Yeah. I noticed how you said the phrase, that's 100% Claudette. It stuck out to me there. If there's certain things where you taste it, like, yes, this tastes like you made it.
Yeah. And I mean, just, it was like a version of the everlasting gobstopper, right? Where you were like, oh, this is the front end. And then it transforms as you're chewing it. And then on the end, you're left with like, I need to go get another one of these. I need to experience that again. Like that is what you hope to achieve when you're creating these experiences, because it is more than a bite. It is like, I want you to understand a little bit more about who I am based on this bite, or bring you to my space. Because for me, that's what it's about. It's sharing the story of who we are.
Speaking of the story of who we are, we have a holiday at the end of this month that food is very much a part of it. And in your interview with Milwaukee Magazine, you were asked about Thanksgiving. And I'll paraphrase to say that you said that you're not anti-Thanksgiving, but you think it should be a day of acknowledgement, either via the food you're eating or via conversation. Can you speak more about that?
Sure. I mean, I'm never going to say don't get together with your family and celebrate thanks of whatever it is. So how the holiday has kind of transformed along the years, it has become its own thing. And although its origins are from a very traumatic moment in history, I feel like we can really take the opportunity of saying, like, yes, this holiday is here, but why is it here? And how can we speak about it differently or engage differently and not have it always be this hyper commercialized day? You know, like, it's like, okay, we're going to end this and we're going to go shopping and we're going to do all of these things. Like, let's pause for a minute and say, like, where I live in Wisconsin, here rurally, it's hunting season. There's long days, right? Like, you look forward to those meals and the time that your family comes to share with you. So, like, have a moment to appreciate the conversation or to get something that's locally sourced and have a conversation about that. Like, our food systems are going to be incredibly transformed over the next few years. Like, that's a proven fact right now. So how can we take this opportunity to have a conversation about it, to talk about local sourcing or about true history of our spaces? I'm not saying that you have to get into a highly in-depth, politically charged conversation, but, like, let's acknowledge that everywhere people live on native land. And so who are the people that occupied that land before you? And how can we maybe start making forward steps into reclaiming what this beautiful space once was?
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to end not with a question, but for you, an invitation for you to have the final word.
Sure. I think the beauty of my job in this moment is emerging from the pandemic. Chefs had a different type of clout and credibility. You know, we almost had to become experts in these fields of sourcing, of advocacy, of, you know, the business part of it all. I think in the end, it is all based on a passion, on this beauty of feeding people. And how are we going to choose to continue to feed people in a greater environment that is constantly going to be changing on us? And I will say that for me as a chef, the beauty has been in the solidarity amongst, you know, the others doing this work. I've been able to meet some incredibly inspiring chefs and have transformative conversation with them who are doing similar but incredibly different work than I am doing. But we all have the same goal of a better tomorrow. So you don't have to be a chef for that to be your goal, right? You can do whatever you'd like in life for that to be your goal. So, like, how can we stand better and stronger together with the end result being a brighter and better tomorrow? You know, I would like to see that happen, even whatever small ripples of change we put into place now.
Well, Elena, thank you so much for spending some time with me and for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Elena Terry is the executive chef and founder of Wild Berries. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. And a new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, but we still need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn all about the history of the Silver City and National Park neighborhoods on Bubbler Talk. And we'll learn how to care for birds this winter in a new episode of Chirp Chat. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm gonna go to the